at the highest ground of Northern Ireland and Western Scotland. Temperatures of 2 degrees in Glasgow, 6 degrees in Enniskillen. So we go through Thursday night. Rain dies away in most places, but could give a spell of snow for a time across the central lowlands of Scotland. And then as we head on into Friday, we're left with a cloudy day and a few dribs and drabs of rain here and there. Well, that's all the weather for now. It's back to David Miles.
Many thanks, Ben. Ben Rich there with the weather. Now to another Ben, because our book of the week is Paul Kildare's new biography of Benjamin Britten, A Life in the 20th Century, read by Alex Jennings. In today's extract, having made a name for himself with Peter Grimes, he embarks on one of his best-known operas, Billy Budd. Firstly, Britten and his partner, the tenor Peter Piers, embark on an exciting adventure.
Like two little banks divided blues.
Britten's bold experiment of 1948 was the inaugural Aldborough Festival, held from the 5th to the 13th of June. A description of Aldborough in an 1844 gazetteer held good 100 years later. It was a seaport, fishing town, and delightful bathing place, rising boldly from the German Ocean. E.M. Forster was less polite about it. "It is a bleak little place, not beautiful. It huddles round a flint-towered church and sprawls down to the North Sea. And what a wallop the sea makes as it pounds at the shingle." The sea exerted a hypnotic influence on Britten, far more so than on any other 20th century composer, and had done since childhood. He was transfixed by its rhythm, its percussive beat punctuating his walks as he set about solving that day's problems. Facilities at the festival were primitive. Eminent artists changed costumes in cottages close to Jubilee Hall, legging it to the wings just in time. The hall's tight fit left the harp with nowhere to go but the edge of the stage. The timpani were muted with colourful eiderdowns. In this first year, there were lectures by Sir Kenneth Clarke on Constable and Gainsborough, Tyrone Guthrie on contemporary theatre, and Forster on Crabbe and Peter Grimes, and what a different work it would have been had he written the libretto. There was also an appearance by Britten and Piers, declaring love and comradeship in a performance of Canticle I. When they stepped out into the chancel of the parish church, their suits and demeanours sombre, they established a precedent that would characterise and subsidise the festival for the next 25 years. Contained within Forster's flights of fancy about a Grimes composed to his libretto was a broad hint. The ageing writer would like to collaborate with Britten on a new opera. So, in mid-January 1949, Forster came and stayed at Crag House in Aldborough for a few days to kick around one of Britten's ideas. Despite the nearly 35-year age gap, they shared a similar background and outlook. Searching for ideas, Britten remembered the small reprint of Herman Melville's Billy Budd he had picked up after the war. Billy Budd is the story of an honest, patriotic, handsome young sailor, press-ganged into the British Navy at the time of the French Revolutionary Wars, who wins the hearts of all those he serves alongside. He is wrongfully and maliciously accused of mutinous deeds by John Claggett, the villainous master-at-arms, whom he strikes and kills with a blow when his severe stammer blocks his words of defence. The man-of-war's respected, bookish Captain Vere, who comprehends that Claggett's vindictive attraction to Billy is the real crime, nonetheless directs the drumhead court to follow to the letter the Mutiny Act. Billy is found guilty and hanged from the yardarm. Claggett is committed to sea with full naval honours. It is a poised, unsettling parable of good and evil, morality and conscience in wartime, an ideal story for Britten. Forster needed little convincing. In early March, he and Eric Crozier, who would collaborate on the libretto, spent 2 weeks at Crag House working on Budd. Each day, immediately after breakfast, they huddled around the fire in Crozier's room, suggesting ideas, scribbling lines, discussing technical points concerning life on a warship. One or both would then write up each episode, and the drafts were pored over, scribbled on, sometimes amalgamated, sometimes scrapped. Britain, at the other end of the corridor, orchestrating his spring symphony, would meet them for elevenses, read what they had written, give his thoughts, and then head back to his study. A beautiful libretto began to emerge. "I like the spring symphony," Britain told Piers later in the month, "apart from one still beastly bit that I can't get right." The piece is a stomp through the pastoral Suffolk of Constable and Gainsborough, schoolboys swimming in the stream at Flatford, even spring light replacing weak winter sunshine. A chill wind blows through the first movement, but soon gives way to the accoutrements of spring, the merry cuckoo, nightingales and larks, all of which Britain latched onto with his keen sense of mimicry. He took Auden's 1933 poem, A Summer Night, and gave it whispery prominence in the symphony's second part. The words jump from the score with a jolt, a reminder of how long ago emotionally their collaborations and lives together were. It was an odd poem to include, dealing with broken love, memory and reconciliation, the paragraphs dealing with reunification left unset. Was Britain's motive here renewal, or was it valediction? The symphony had its premiere in Amsterdam. Piers was singing, of course, joined by the Dutch soprano Jo Vincent and Kathleen Ferrier, who is the soloist here. And in good voice they were too, if this private, crackly, off-air recording of the performance is anything to go by. With the symphony off his desk, the Budd collaborators gathered again in Aldborough. The working pattern continued throughout 1949 and much of the following year, until Britain retreated into his study in Aldborough with his huge manuscript, printed with more staves than he had had to think about in some years, Spring's symphony aside, and both his collaborators found themselves kept at bay. The opera had still not been officially commissioned, despite various high-level conversations about how it might fit into the planned 1951 Festival of Britain. In the end, Covent Garden announced plans for the premiere in December 51. And there were other, quite different hurdles ahead. Forster was 71 and slowing down. He needed to be met at train stations or deposited back in Cambridge. "Oh, my darling, darling Ben, please don't drive so fast, my dear, dear darling." He could not comprehend Britain's fast pace and full diary, nor his tendency to abandon Bud mid-sentence for other commitments. Forster's health was fragile, and he was worried, not entirely melodramatically, that he might die before completing the libretto. In March and April 1950, he bedded down at Crag House, recuperating from a prostate operation, recording in his diary his many ailments with almost ghoulish fascination. It was in Aldborough that he heard for the first time his Act One words set to music. What remarkable occasions the informal first performances must have been. Basil Coleman, who was to direct the first production of Bud, was transfixed by a later complete playthrough. He recalled, "As well as playing from the piano score, Britain half sang all the vocal parts, giving a vivid idea of the characterizations he had in mind. And as the daylight faded in the room round him and the terrible events of the story developed, Britain became more and more immersed in them himself. At the finish, he was exhausted, physically and emotionally." Unfortunately, Forster had reservations concerning an aria in Act Two. A week later, he wrote to Britain. "I want passion. Love constricted, perverted, poisoned, but nevertheless flowing down its agonizing channel. A sexual discharge gone evil, not soggy depression or growling remorse. The reaction crippled Britain, who sought solace and advice from Piers and Crozier, the latter sagely telling him not to tinker with the aria until he had completed the next act. Crozier then told Forster of the composer's extreme sensitivity to the slightest criticism, information the writer greeted with surprise and gratitude. With distance, however, Britten decided that Forster was perhaps onto something, for in July the following year he refashioned the aria. The problem was that Forster was used to greater deference than he thought the collaboration afforded. To the many writers and scholars and young gay men in his address book, he was a venerated elder statesman of English letters. Nothing in his previous friendship with Britten prepared him for the composer's single-mindedness. Forster could himself be prickly. When this same November Britten and Crozier called on Forster in Cambridge to discuss a troubling scene, eminent writer bawled out eminent composer, addressing him like some low-class servant who deserved to be whipped. Then he stalked off into the night. A coda to this episode appears in Forster's final diary entry for 1950. "I am rather a fierce old man at moments, and he is rather a spoilt boy, and certainly a busy one." For the first time since working with Auden on Paul Bunyan, Britten had a librettist whose talent matched his own. Before a word was written, Forster had told the composer about the novella's lovable and hateable human beings connected with immensities through the tricks of art. It was not a bad lodestar, and Britten responded with his own great tricks of art. He braided Melville's silver whistles into the score, each as shrill as a seahawk. He created a battle scene of visceral impact, cut through with thrilling martial fanfares and booming great guns of war. He played with the dull, insistent rhythm of the sea and gave the sailors lyrical lullabies and jocular shanties to sing. And at the moment following Billy's hanging, he composed music of overwhelming expressionistic power, a violent gesture unequalled in his output. Taking his cue from Melville, who describes a muffled murmur of capricious to revulsion emanating from Billy's crewmates as they witnessed the dangling corpse, Britten gave his chorus grunting, violent cries, which teeter on the edge of revolt, and which only then are put down forcibly by the ship's lieutenants. It is a shivery, unforgettable moment in the theatre. From senior management down to the cast's smallest powder monkey, Covent Garden did him proud. John Piper's set was a ship where the ghostly, unpainted wood of the main deck formed a brilliant contrast to the pitch-black backdrop, while between decks looked like the bleached skeleton of a whale, a spinal column linking a mass of ribs. The lighting operators did their best to give the team the atmosphere on stage they sought, the moody shadows beneath deck, and the stark contrast of the great whale bones. In all aspects, Britten was thrilled with the courtesy and cooperation, with the willingness of everyone to get behind the difficult new work, to soak up its language, to respect its dark, unsettling themes. Kenneth Clark caught Forster after the opening performance on the 1st of December and told him, rather wonderfully, that it was one of the great masterpieces that change human conduct. Audiences and critics were less sure. With distance, Britten was able to write to Forster on his 80th birthday in 1958, remembering with pleasure the collaboration, observing that "the result is certainly one of my best operas, although the world is going to take some time to find that out." He was completely right.
Alex Jennings was reading from Benjamin Britten, A Life in the 20th Century by Paul Kildare. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. Now the shipping forecast is just a matter of a minute or so away. And so to take us there, we have that peaceful prelude which takes us sailing by. And now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015. Today, Thursday, the 7th of February. There are warnings of gales in Viking, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Humber, Thames, Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, high 200 miles west of Fitzroy. Slow moving with little change by 1800 today. New low expected southeast Iceland, 1004 by the same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking north 6 to gale 8, becoming variable 4 later. Snow showers, good, occasionally poor. North at 0, south at 0. Northerly 5 or 6, becoming variable 4. Snow showers, good.